So my pleasure to be with all of you. And as I've been coming here, I think, 3 years, it was wonderful to see new people, and I have many old friends here. Even I see people that have been with me in India and will come. So it's very nice. Professor Bryant. Wonderful. I can't speak too highly about Professor Bryant, who happens to be a very old friend of mine. I was already in an ashram, and I was already a monk. And in 1981, he came and joined that ashram. And since then, that's over 30 years we've been friends. And he's a wonderful soul. He lives in Princeton. Very spiritual person. And I'm a monk, so I wander around. Don't necessarily have my own place, but somehow sometimes people give me something. And I would stay with him often. And a lot of times when he was translating and writing books, I would get the manuscript before it was even published. I guess what's that called? A scoop? And the scoop on it. And it was great, you know, to teach things that people never heard before. So I actually got this when it was in a manuscript form, and I guess on a disc or something was put on my computer, and I got to see it. It was very interesting study. It's not exactly my particular school, so it wasn't something that I was thoroughly conversant with as I would in the bhakti tradition. In Indian philosophy, there are 6 schools of thought. I guess it begins from something called the Vedas. It's a concept. It's a beautiful concept that this world is created for a purpose, and how to use this world is also manifest along with the creation of this world. It almost has like an image of God breathing out, God said, let there be light. So sound comes before form. There too. God said. And through the syllable om, it comes. And the same thing that creates has a vibration, a knowledge that allows you, enables you how to use it. It's very, very comprehensive. And I was just checking if I had my cell phone on me, so I would shut it off so I wouldn't be embarrassed. There are 6 schools. And what those schools are, they're not given in the original Vedas. Vedas means knowledge. They're not given in the original Vedas. But people who would take to spiritual paths in different ways would take the Vedic knowledge and see where that particular subject was, and then kind of codify it and then make a school out of it. So there are actually 6 schools of knowledge. I'm just listing, it's kind of interesting. Right? There's Visheshika, atomism. Basically, it's kind of like science, material science. Then there's Mamamsa. Mamamsa is kind of rituals, basically. Then there is Nyaya, logic. Then there is Vedanta, scriptural analysis. Then there is Sankhya, philosophical analysis. And then there is yoga, which is spiritual discipline based on the mind, which is, and we can say it's psychology. So yoga is really dealing with psychology, it deals with the mind. So, you know, all the schools have a little bit of different things, a little bit different, but they obviously have yoga in different ways. But yoga was basically specifically just dealing, you know, with the mind. So I am in the school of Vedanta, theistic Vedanta, where the bhakti tradition is. So it wasn't something that I extensively read. Even today, giving this class posed a little bit of a challenge to me. I hope I'm rising to the challenge. You know, for the last 2 weeks, I did not eat before noon. I just didn't want to stop, you know, the studies. You know, all of my morning meditations, just keep on the studies to really get this down and understand it. And not only understand the subject, but understand how to teach it according to the circumstances. So I hope I understand it deeply, but what I lack in scholarship, I hope I make up for in teaching. And I had kind of a little bit of a strategy, seeing that it was 12 hours, and how many songs and dances I'll need to keep people's attention. I had a little bit of a strategy which I'm going to employ a bit. And the strategy is, I think I'm going to concentrate a little bit today on the second verse, on the word chitta, or mind. And I think what I want to do is really spend a little more time describing what the mind is. Because I think if you understand what the mind is, then you have the theme to understand everything else. Every book has a theme. The theme is kind of, any essay you have should have a theme. Life should have a theme. The world has a theme. It's that idea which connects everything else, although it appears unrelated. You know, if you know the theme, you know how everything is related. So I think, you know, really I want to concentrate on the mind. And I think it's also the most practical. This book, I found by studying it in my own practice, yeah, as Bryn said, there's a lot of practical information in this. There's also a lot of information that's not so practical. Because it deals, and in fact, I wasn't even sure how to teach it, because I'm not even sure it was expressed properly, because they deal with states of consciousness that are without thought. And therefore, it's basically, the thing about yoga, the philosophy doesn't come first, the experience comes first. It's about the, I'm saying people who are into this, the psychology, you know, schools of thought were developed, and when they kind of codified the knowledge, you know, things they had to describe were things that they couldn't describe. So I don't think it's I'll spend too much on the technical verses describing those states, but basically mention them or something like that. But I myself, my own personal practices, I do a lot of meditation. It was extremely helpful to read the Yoga Sutras. Extremely helpful. But on the other hand, Professor Bryant, I don't think he even teaches it anymore. He wants to teach more Gita, which is more action-oriented. This is, you know, real yoga is, I think we'll glean very important things from it. But the real text, and I'm just going to quote Professor Bryant, if there's any way incorrect, all the blame goes to him. He said, it's not for ladies in the city practicing yoga. not me. It was for ascetics, actually. But that's what I'm saying. You have to glean what we can relate to, but it was for ascetics. It's like amazing. I mean, when you think, I'm going to talk about Ishvara Pranidhan because it's an important part of that. That it ultimately comes, and you'll see in the text, that to actually be a successful yogi, you need mercy. And mercy means undeserved. In other words, even the yogis thousands of years ago, they had practically no hope that they can achieve perfection by their own endeavor. It's inconceivable, you know. You have to meditate on one object, right? On one thing. There was a strategy. I'm going to describe the basic strategy. I'm going to also go through the text, but I think I have to couch everything. There's a basic strategy. You know, you have to meditate. Oh, Shannon, welcome. It got caught in traffic, but it's great that you're here. Okay? We just started. So nice to see both of you. They came all the way from Wilmington, Delaware. Just make yourself comfortable. To meditate on one, I'll just share the progression. This is what it is. The first thing you have to do is you have to leave the city. Okay? Second thing, complete celibacy. Then you have to focus on one thing, right? Without any other thoughts, right? See if you can even do that for a minute. All right? So, you know, when you're in the world, you know, there's so many things. My God, oh God, it's either like he did this, she did this to me, or I have to pay this bill, or I have, you know, wow. And you have to meditate on one thing. And then, you not only have to meditate, you can't, like the mind would be something like this. It would be like something taking it. He described the Yoga Sutras very much. It's like you're watching a movie, right? And you're watching a movie, so there's frames. And that's actually how the mind works. So there's frames of the movie. So what yoga means is the same thing as in every frame. Right? It's not like this. Well, I meditate on the Mahamantra, so it'd be like this. Hare Krishna. That rascal. Tired. You know, it's not like that. It has to be the same thing for so long. And then that's the beginning. Then you have to go beyond the thing itself. So you have to experience the object without any conception. No thought. You just have to experience the object without any thought. Then it's called tanmatra. You have to experience the primordial, they're called tanmatras. They're the elements behind the objects. It's a very interesting. Then you have to experience the material substance which everything is created, then, and it goes and goes with these different steps of samadhi, and then there comes the end where there's just one thought in your consciousness. I don't like to think. I don't want thoughts. And then so it's interesting. But the preliminary function of how the mind works is really what fascinates me. And I think if I can explain that, and then we'll go through the verses. I just thought I actually I wrote an article here. Actually, I just based on the Yoga Sutras, called "Is There Therapy in the Vedas?" I'll tell you why sometime why I gave that title. Now, I want to explain yoga in just another basic core way, and then we'll go to the texts. Okay? And I've gotten this actually from sitting in a Yoga Sutra class by someone who studied with Krishna Namacharya for 30 years. A great scholar called A.G. Mohan. I was sitting in his class, and what a brilliant teacher he was. And that's where I got my famous three questions, which I'll ask the class here, because this is actually where it should have been asked. This is okay. And it'll set up the understanding, I think, there. The first question is, see, and we also have a game here. And the game is, if anybody answers yes to all three questions, they get to sit on the seat. And I have to go to the audience, because it means you're more qualified than me. And if someone answers yes to all three questions, they may be enlightened, but probably they're either a liar or they're crazy. So we'll try it. But try. You may answer. Don't worry. You probably can answer at least two. If you answer, you have to answer yes. I want to just, again, couch this in the proper understanding. Because this is what it's all about. What you're doing right here, what you're studying here, what you're practicing here is about what? Finding sublimity. Right? That's what you want. Otherwise, that's called faith. In Sanskrit, it's called Shraddha. Shraddha is where you trust your sublimity lies. What it's all about. You want teachings? It's all about finding sublimity. About finding happiness. That's what these teachings are about. Different people have different opinions on how you go about it. Some are wrong, some are right, and some have other ways of doing it. Okay, so the first question is, have you found what you are looking for? Now, I'll just say that someone has won the Powerball. And they said, yes. And someone else has said, just last week, I met my soulmate. Another person said, I was elected class president. So you said yes, and you're still in the running. And the next question is it eternal? Because if you've chosen as your object of faith something that's not eternal, you've chosen the wrong object of faith, because it will be filled with duality. These two things. It'll be the happiness you get from it and the anxiety that it's temporary and the sorrow that you've lost it. So it will not ultimately be satisfying. That being said, I want to make it clear, because this is an ascetic text, that it's also couched in a philosophy that understands that for the mind to be peaceful, you also have to be satisfied. So they may talk about renunciation, they may talk about those types, but they also understand that, well, in this text, it's at the level where you got to leave everything, basically. If you want to do the whole yoga thing to the end, you got to leave everything. But that's before that, you have to be satisfied. In my tradition, it says you don't live to enjoy. You don't live to eat, you eat to live. You don't live to enjoy, you enjoy to live. So there's a certain amount of satisfaction there. So sometimes you talk renunciation, we're talking about your ultimate goal of happiness. There are temporary things that you should try to get for that. That's not a problem. So, is it eternal? Well, if you chose something that's temporary, then you've chosen the wrong object of trust. Then, what you may have said, I have found yoga, which is to an eternal thing. I found Krishna, I found Jesus. Just to intersperse it with just a little story, just to keep you all awake and alive. You know, I've been giving lectures in the yoga world, and you know, people are interested in this tradition, and they start with a frame of reference. 2 days ago, I happened to be in a situation where I was giving a lecture to right-wing conservative Christians. Yeah, really. It was. Bryn, I'll send you the picture. It's an amazing thing, right? This guy with this leather jacket and the cowboy hat and the whole thing. It was in a very, very fascinating. I would say they were economically conservative, but socially kind of altruistic, liberal, deeply pious people. But I was just thinking, when I was upstairs waiting for the lecture and I was looking at all my notes, and I didn't even know what they accept, what they don't accept, what can I say, what can I not say. It was really just fascinating. And all I could do is I kept on preparing my lecture, and after a while I just prayed, man, I just want to serve them in some way. But it worked out successfully, but that's another story. Three of them have taken up mantra meditation. But it was fascinating. Okay, so you may have picked something that's eternal. Then the third question, are you always living within what you have faith in? And that brings you to the point, and that was A.G. Mohan's point, that brings you to the point of yoga. Because that's what the purpose of yoga is. It's to come to some state of realization of the Purusha, or yourself. which is the objective or goal of spiritual life, is to realize yourself and be yourself. And in these kinds of conceptions or understanding, that is a naturally wonderful state, something that you're really satisfied with. And that's why people search for it. So that's really what yoga is. That's what all spiritual paths are. It's to find some kind of state of sublimity that you can always reside in. And if that doesn't exist, then you should think of suicide. That's existential philosophy. The existential philosophy, where they see that there's no actual ultimate meaning in life. Other philosophers like the existentialists, but they don't believe it. But they don't believe in it, but they like it because they feel at least they embrace their conclusions. And their conclusion is, well, should I live or not live? So there's a... So this is actually the goal. And this is basically how yoga works. Basically. And then we're going to go into the text a bit. One thing is, well, okay, I'm just going to deal with the mind a little bit. I'm not getting into the elaborate description. That'll come later. But just basically, I'll just say something like this. The mind is... the mind is like a lens. And the goal of spirituality is to actually see things properly. There's actually a concept. And I think you'll even find this concept in modern psychology or any type of self-improvement. They're really trying to help you see things properly because they understand that your anxiety is because of your phobias and your fears and the ways you project it on things. And if you can actually see what's there, it's not that bad. And in spiritual life, it means if you actually see what's there, it's not only not bad, it's a wonderful ecstatic state. You should go for this. So why are you not seeing what's there? Because the lens is either you look at it as dirty, so you can't see the proper reflection through it, or you look at it as distorted, right? And what's it distorted by? I have to say the thoughts, the selfish thoughts, really distort the mind. Just think what hate does to the mind. How do you see the world when you have hate? How do you see the world when you have insatiable cravings? How do you see the world when you have greed? You see the world in terms of your own desire. Wow, that's nice. It belongs to me. Let me take it. So it's distorted. And therefore, the goal, one of the goals of yoga... And I think like Bryn said, it's a lot of different terms, so I think you have to approach it from different ways. One of the goals of yoga is somehow or other to still the mind and therefore purify that lens and bring it to a higher level of perception and therefore contentment. In yoga, it means that you'll ultimately see yourself. And seeing yourself will ultimately enable you to live in yourself and to be yourself. And even if you're not going to take to this path as your path to achieve that, understanding the science of how the mind works will bring you to a different level of consciousness, no matter what your path is. even in that sense, and Professor Bryant made this point, and I think it's very valuable to the class, a lot of reasons why people take, not one of the reasons why people take yoga, even the exercise, you know. Actually, I was thinking this even when I was out in that lecture with the conservative Christians. Because one thing that was nice, there was this one young man that he was homeschooled. You know, and he had very nice parents. I mean, really dedicated, nice parents. And very intelligent parents. And actually, he was 12 years old, and he was sitting in the front of the class, listening attentively. And after the class, he shook my hand. "Thank you very much, sir." And he hugged me. You know, really nice looking guy. And then, but I thought, it's really strange, but just to keep you alive, I intersperse these stories, maybe it's the thing. He lives in the middle of Pennsylvania. Now, you want to know a definition for Pennsylvania? Philadelphia and Pittsburgh with Alabama in between. That's the definition. So I was right there. Now, this is just throw your mind, how it's possible. You know what this young boy's dedicated his life to? Surfing. What? Surfing. He's number 5 in the country for his age. Now, the puzzle which I'll answer at the end of the class is, how can someone living in the middle of Pennsylvania be a surfing champ? But his parents homeschool him, so 7 months of the year he spends by the ocean. That's the end of the day. But, and I spoke to him, he does it 10 hours a day, and I saw this person was very well grounded. He was very confident, not humble, but confident in himself. It was really wonderful to see a young boy like that. But I just thought, I mean, besides having good parents, that they're really nice people. They're some of the people that are taking up the mantra chanting. But just the fact that he has to be so concentrated on one thing creates a certain peace of the mind. And I think that's with yoga, you know, to do those exercises, you know. So you get a certain relief. But it's scientific. Why? Because you have to focus for a certain amount and concentrate for a certain amount. So it has that effect. Okay, now we'll go to the first verse and we'll begin to discuss. It's a sutra. Atta yoganu shasana. Now the teachings of yoga are presented. Now, a sutra, it comes from a Sanskrit word that means thread. Sutra means it's a code. It's an aphorism. And if you want to understand anything about the Yoga Sutras, you have to understand what a sutra itself is. Because it codifies knowledge, because it was the system of learning in those days. It's kind of, Cliff Notes is a bad analogy. They would make codes. And what they would do is it would enable people to memorize large bodies of knowledge by having a code of words that they can unpack. Now, the relevance of this for studying the sutras is that they're written at a certain time and they make as many assumptions as possible about what people know. In other words, they won't say things that they think people know. They'll make assumptions that people know this when they say a particular word, or they don't clarify something because everyone knows this. The problem is, today people don't know it. So they can't just read the sutras. So what it is there's commentators that unpack the meaning of the sutras. They unpack the meaning of the sutras. Professor Bryant is, besides being one of the most compassionate and humble people that I know, he's an incredible scholar. An incredible scholar. And his presentation is so clear. And there are six commentators. And the main commentator is called Vyas. Now, Vyas is a term that, you see these Vedas, they're so vast, right? But they have to be communicated. And what communication means, you have to take some knowledge and change the shape of it without losing the meaning of it, so that your audience can understand, right? Like, for example, somehow it's one of the threads, the conservative Christians. One part of my lecture, even someone in the back said, "Amen, brother." Anyway, imagine what I was talking about. Many things. So, you have to... So Vyasadeva means, Deva means editor. Vyasa means editor, and Deva means godly editor. There's a concept that there's an incarnation of God that edits things. When he takes knowledge and he makes it more clear. So they don't know if this is the original Vyas or a person named after him, or the commentator assumed that name. But there's six commentaries here, and Vyas is the main one, and everyone else follows his commentary. Very interesting. So atah. So in the just to show you what a sutra means, in my tradition, they have the Vedanta Sutras. This is the Yoga Sutras. So Vedanta Sutra, the first aphorism, and it's relevant here, is atato brahma jigyasa. Atato, now, brahma, atato brahma, God, the divine, jigyasa, inquiry. So you see people take it. Atato means now. It means what? It's important, right? It's significant. And then they go, why is it significant? What does now mean? Now means that there's transmigration of the soul, that Armanda Brahmate, Konya Bhagavan Jeev, Guru Krishna Pasadi Pai Bhakti. You're wandering from universe to universe, from species of life to species of life, right? And then all of a sudden you have the human form of life. Atato, now, the human form of life. Why is it so urgent? Because now you have the capacity, jigyasa, to inquire. Inquire about what? Inquire about why are you suffering. You have free will now. You can actually make choices to better yourself. What's the difference? And my teacher was asked, what's the difference between a human being and an animal? He said, a human being can ask the question, why I am suffering? So significant. Why? When you ask the question, why I am suffering, then you have to ask, what did I do wrong? Because suffering is the incongruence between what you are and what you're doing. When you go against nature, you suffer. So, atato brahma jigyasa. So, why am I suffering? What did I do wrong? Then the next question is, what should I be doing? Then the next question is, who am I? Because what you should be doing is based on what you're made of and what you're made for. Then it comes to the point, the most important thing in that search for sublimity, the most important thing in that search for sublimity is what? To understand the self. Because if you don't understand what you're made of and what you're made for, how can you know what to do? How can you create a congruence between your thoughts, your activities, and your core essence or core being? So that's from Vedanta Sutra. And you just unpack it. It has so much meaning. So atata. So here, this word atta in the Yoga Sutras, it's very interesting. It means, first of all, it's not now like a unit of time now, right? Like now can indicate a unit of time. It's not that kind of now. It indicates now in terms of a level of maturity. Now that you've matured and you're actually able now to think of something beyond just eating, mating, sleeping, and defending. Now where you want to search for something a little bit higher, now there's a maturity in your life. And in the school, each school, because they promote their own school, they'll say now that you've gone through all other systems, so now also indicates hierarchical. Now that you've did this and did this and did this, now. Especially with yoga, because it's whatever it is, it takes such a high level of renunciation. So it indicates an urgency, the word, and so much can talk about that urgency, that you have the capacity, the facility to do it. If you've come to this really, and you're going to practice yoga, and this is going to be your text, there's certainly a maturity of your life. Even in this life, to actually come to this, and maybe you've already gone through and fulfilled all your desires and so many things. Now you're ready to retire, whatever. Or now that you've gone through so many other paths and so many, this is important. Atta, then yoga. And yoga means now. Quell the thoughts. Work on it. Now fix your mind. And you know, it's also, there's so many meanings to yoga. And I had a fear when I first came. What am I going to talk about? Now I kind of fear maybe I won't get out of the first verse. It won't be like that.
Yeah, yep. You know, funny thing, the first time Bryn and I ever studied with Professor Bryant was so long ago when we went to a sutra workshop. Yeah. We were only able to attend like the first night. It was like, it was the similar thing where there was like three sessions or four sessions.
Yeah.
And I have my notes from it. And he only got through number one. Just so you know. Like, he only got to
that. Okay, so I don't feel so bad. And also, this is the only one I prepared, too. That's another story. You'll see if you stay longer, so I gotta keep it going. Anyway, I'm in the bhakti path. We're dedication, so not renunciation, so I could use my desire to be a stand-up comedian. Okay. In service of teaching, so it's just like... So, it's true though. Yoga. So, yeah, quelling the mind. And it's very interesting too. It describes here. And I'm thinking how practical it is for me in my own type of practice, because I do a lot of meditation. And lately, I've been traveling and lecturing a lot more, and there's not been as much time, but that's also my meditation. So, they describe that there's five states of the mind. When a mind is directed towards an object, it can have different levels of focus, right? So it can be wandering, It can be confused. It can be distracted. It can be concentrated. And it can be completely restrained. Now, without explaining that, it says yoga is only the last two. It's when the mind is actually either concentrated or restrained, which I guess is different levels of meditation. Well, restrained would be the complete, it's completely controlled. Actually, it's the two stages of yoga, right? There's some pragyata samadhi, where it's concentrated on something, right? On one thing, that's yoga. Or, it's not only concentrated on one thing, it's restrained from anything, and that's asampragyata samadhi. Right? That's yoga. And you know, so for me, when I heard this, it kind of, and this is a thing also that's so important. Just, it's really, this is such a wonderful thing I heard recently. In terms of yoga, the reason why we hear teachings, we discussed this in my last class too, is getting good ideas from an authoritative source of knowledge. And what good ideas are those ideas that help you to purify and control the mind and elevate the mind. So when you hear the proper idea, it can become a proper thought within you. Proper thought that stays within you, not just even a thought, but the impression of the thought, which is called a samskara. You can get the proper to, you get the thoughts in your mind that help you to control your mind and elevate your consciousness. It's not going to come unless you hear. That's why at Yoga Maya, I am blessed and humbled to have the service to have such sons here to try to, from the teachings which I've learned for so many years, trying to give people some good ideas. Because that'll improve their life more than anything else. So I was thinking, even from these studying and reading, in my own meditation, it really said, wait a second, it's not yoga if I'm concentrated, concentrated, and then wandering. Concentrated, concentrated, distracted. You know, I really have to make it yoga. So I myself, I'm constantly hearing and improving by hearing all these type of ideas. You know, that's the way it is. That's why it's so important to have shastras, spiritual teachings, and hear spiritual teachings. Because the way the mind works, you won't be able to keep an abundance of good thoughts. And if you don't keep an abundance of good thoughts, there's two directions the mind goes. When you do have good thoughts, and based on that good thoughts, you have good actions, the mind will morph to a higher level of perception and contentment. And when you have bad thoughts and bad actions, it'll morph to a lower level of thought. And so I thought, even reading this to myself, how important it was. And then, so, Atta Yoga Anushasanam. Anushasanam means to shasanam, teachings. Anushasanam. Now it is time to follow, it's time for the teachings of yoga, but it also says yoga, which is following teachings. And what he's doing is he's saying, this is not my philosophy. And then the history of it is, there's a history in the Vedas, in the things, of this philosophy of discipline, of controlling the mind, of which part of it is asana. And the Yoga Sutras, I don't know, maybe there's two verses out of 700. So now it's following teachings. It's there in the teachings. And those of you who have the book and want to read further, It gives the history of where those teachings lie. But it's not, it's coming in tradition. And recently I also heard a very nice thing. This is called parampara. If you want to have knowledge, you have to come in a line of teachers. Because the only way you can understand something which at the present moment you don't see and understand is to get it from someone who does see and understand. So that's called guru parampara. A line of people who have experience in whatever subject. So you have yoga teachers, but they have yoga teachers. And then you become yoga teachers. Why? Because you're learning from someone who has experience. You're being told to bend your body in a particular way. You have no idea why or what the effect would be. And there's no way you can find out unless you're being told by someone who had experience doing that and experienced the benefit. And that's the teacher. And when you have teachers that don't have experience, you don't learn anything. So they call that, it's a very nice, there's a term in Sanskrit for blind that's called andha. Yata yadandai upaniyamanas. It says a blind man leading a blind man will fall into a ditch. Right? So that's called andha. It means, like blind means what? Blind is not just the eyes. But if we take it to be the eyes, just look. You want to learn about color and the shades of color, you have to have it from a person who's seen what color is. If they haven't seen what color is, then they can't teach you about what color is. So significant. Ata yoga nushasana. Now the teachings of yoga are presented. What was there? What was understood? What was more important? Experienced by the people. And in this kind of tradition, they always feel there's a lineage that goes back to some divine transcendental reality. It doesn't begin just whimsically. Okay. Unlike Professor Bryant, I'm going to continue to the next verse. Okay? But we can have questions. If there are. Okay. Generally, things are clear. I'm cursed that I very rarely get questions. Okay. Okay. Now, the first verse introduced yoga, and now it's going to define it. It's so nice. Scholarship. Okay? So, yoga refers to kind of a cluster of practices, various disciplines dealing with the mind, which was gleaned from the original Vedas. So now you need a definition of it. So Patanjali gives the definition as stilling the thoughts. Yoga means stilling the changing states of the mind, and the idea is when you're following that, you won't be reflecting on yourself. This is a theory. When you're following that, then you won't be reflecting on yourself. It's bringing you away from that inner reflection on the self. And in fact, there's one verse in Bhagavad Gita that says, when the senses are controlled, the super soul is at reach. There's a conception that within the heart, God is also sitting to give you information. And that when you're external, when your consciousness is completely external, trying to eat the fruits of happiness and distress, you can't reflect neither on yourself or on the divine within your heart. And they give an analogy in the Svetashvatara Upanishads, very, as two birds are sitting on a tree. One bird is eating the fruits of happiness and distress. One is witnessing. So the witnessing bird is considered like God. There's a voice in the heart, a conscience, a direction. A little bit different school, but it's the same point. When you're externally absorbed, you can't reflect on the inner self. Again, just to keep you alive, because I realize I'm with you 12 hours, every once in a while I'll insert something that you'll go, what? When I initially came to this path and my parents hired deprogrammers to kidnap me, what? And captured me and tried to mess with my mind and get me out of the faith and trust that I was there. Not going to go into that story, but they weren't successful. But I had an experience, and one experience was, because I wasn't eating, I wasn't talking, I would not relate to them in any way, no matter what they say or do to me, and the senses became so controlled. And then I, at a particular point, this is true, I had a prayer, please, I want to get out of this situation. And I heard such a profound voice of intelligence that directed me in such a profound way in detail how to actually escape. It's another story, but it's like that. Once you restrain and control the externals, you'll come in contact with something inside. In yoga, it's your own self. So, now let's Now the other thing is, of these six schools of thought, there's generally a practice of it and a philosophy of it, basically. Or there's a philosophical side of it, which also has a practice, but then there's a practical side of it, which also has a philosophy. Yoga is very much linked with Sankhya. And Sankhya is philosophical analysis. It's really trying to understand the world and what exists. So basically, what I'd like to do now is this word that says yoga is controlling chitta. It's the mind. It's quelling the thoughts of the mind. The chitta means the fluctuations of the mind. Right? And when you do that, whether you're an exact adherence of yoga philosophy or not, there's a certain clarity that comes. a certain clarity that comes, that you'll see everything more clearly. And in this philosophy, it says you'll see yourself more clearly. And you'll see yourself in such a way more clearly that you'll want to be free of all thoughts, so that you're just dwelling and living in the self alone. So this is basically what's described here, is that there's basically two things. There's Purusha, which is spirit or the soul, and then there's Prakriti, which is matter. We're not matter, but somehow or other, this consciousness becomes reflected on matter, and therefore begins somehow or other to identify with it. And this matter means not only the physical body, but the subtle body called the mind. By the way, you're really great students. You take notes and you listen. It's just amazing. You really, really want to learn. It's just a pleasure to be here. It's great. So, the mind is... It's the Sanskrit term is vikara. It's transforming. The mind and body is transforming. Even on the physical platform, you're born, you grow, you stay for some time, you reproduce, dwindle, die. So when that consciousness, eternal consciousness, is reflected on the mind and body, then and in ignorance thinks that's what I am, then you suffer the indignity of those transformations. Getting back to the conservative Christians, I'll tell you a little bit. It's a little bit related here, but just to... Interesting. This was my strategy. So what am I going to do here? It gets wilder than that. The guy I'm staying with is a forensic scientist and the chief coroner of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. His wife is wild. Is former Miss Texas, who sings Latin songs under the name of Yaya. And even the guy met me, and his wife was like the singer and that, and he says, if you want to understand us, he says, think of I Love Lucy in reverse. I don't know if you go back that far, but Lucille Ball, Desi Arnaz, he was Spanish, and she's Spanish, and he's... Anyway, here's my strategy. You know, when I was walking with Graham in the woods today, it's true, I took a walk with him over his Ponderosa, his big farm. I didn't have any shoes. He gave me these shoes, and I had to find some pants and get out there on a walking stick. I said, I just remembered that some of my deepest spiritual experiences were in Juniata County. And it happened to be true that the place where I was, 50 minutes from there, was a spiritual ashram that I spent some of the deepest spiritual meditation in. And that ashram, they were also on the edge of their seats, and that ashram was... The head of that ashram was a good friend of mine, was a black man born in the ghettos of Cleveland who graduated from Princeton University, became the first African-American Swami, and was a tribal chief. Okay, that's how it began. They were interested. Yeah. But then, the other interesting part was, and this is related to what's here, is that my teacher, at the very end of his life, he was headed to that farm because he wanted to teach people how to live off the land. And then I explained my teacher's death and how when someone is a spiritual person and becomes free from that ignorance, which is the identification of the soul or thinking that the body and mind is the self, and therefore suffers or fears the illusion of non-existence. Death is the illusion of non-existence. So in spiritual philosophy, somehow or other, one has to become, at least in yoga, there's somehow a connection. And what does it describe? It's described in the Yoga Sutra. What is suffering? It says what suffering is this is the soul and this is the body. When the pure, eternal, blissful Purusha or soul identifies with or thinks it is the temporary suffering and impure body. Right? So, when you're reflected on all those, the mind and all those thoughts, which are basically born of that ignorance, then you start to identify with that. And if you can stop that, then the mind becomes a lens, and the soul is be able to look in there and not see the world through that ego, I am the enjoyer, I am the controller, but it actually starts to see itself. And that's yoga is the stilling of the changing states of the mind. Now, what I want to do now is just basically explain what the citta is in a very practical way. And I'm actually going to give a very practical exercise that is going to help you to understand that, even when you leave and go home. I've actually brought it here in this box. You'll see. Okay. Citta in Sanskrit means the mind. Right? But it refers to the composite of three various functions that the mind has. Mind is the subtle body. You have a subtle body, you have a gross body. So it has three divisions. One is, it's called ahankara, manas, and buddhi. And basically, the three functions of the mind are, well, the part called the manas, what it does is through the senses, it identifies things and ascribes feelings to them. It's not necessarily rational. Right? It's based on your previous experiences. You see something, right? And you can say, oh, if someone is prejudiced, right? They may see, they identify, that's a woman, and their feelings, I hate women. Or that's a woman, I must exploit women. Or that's a woman, I must respect. It you ascribe some type of feeling based on your past experience. Then you have the buddhi. The buddhi makes judgments. It's not impulsive. It's not how I feel about something, but what I understand about something. This is it. I feel this way, but that's not actually correct. This is what it is. Right? Man, I hate men. Right? Maybe because when I was young, men treated me and I got that impression that men are bad, but now I have intelligence. No, I was treated badly, but that's a man, but there are different types of men. And let me see. So basically, one is impulsive analysis. Then one is basically rational analysis. And then one is called ahankara. It's the self-conception we have. The self-identity we have. And it's interesting. What ahankara does, it takes consciousness and delimits it to a particular type of body. Like you're an ant. The ant is the same soul. But consciousness was delimited. And ultimately, say, for a yogi, if he becomes free from those influences, his consciousness is no longer limited. Therefore, they say the yogi can even be omniscient. His consciousness can expand further. So here's the nature of this mind. And remember, what is this mind and body for? The mind and body is for this. Somehow you're the soul, your awareness, you're pure, right? But somehow or other there's ego, enjoyment and control. So therefore you assume an identity like that. Now, I'm going to go for 5 minutes and then we'll take a 5 minute break only. And if you're not back in 5 minutes, then I don't give breaks the next time. I think that's fair, right? Or just be responsible, okay? Because I was told what happens, even though you're always on time to the class and but if you get a break, it's like, whoa. Okay? So it's kind of, this is like mercy. It's undeserved kindness. I don't deserve a break, but I'm giving it to you. And don't exploit my kindness. So the mind is malleable. I'm going to approach it from a different way. The mind is malleable. It's just the nature of the mind. And according to the shape or form of the mind, then you will feel in a particular way. It's just a fact. And now one thing I'm going to have to explain. I'm going to have to explain these terms, and then we can go through the rest of the sutras. You have to understand guna. You have to understand klesha. You have to understand samskara. And then you have to understand vritti. But you have to first understand guna. Guna means rope or thread. Everything subtle or gross is composed of matter, threads of matter called gunas, that allow you to conduct various egotistical activities. And there's basically three forms of enjoyment. One is inertia. People like to sleep. They like to do nothing. There's, that's called mode of ignorance. Sanskrit is tamas. There's passion, which is called rajas. That's intense activity. More. I want more, better. If you look at the hands, I generally do it in the hands. So we'll start with the gunas. So here, this is the mode of ignorance. We'll first start sattva. The term sattva means the nature of being. When things are in its proper place, it's called sattva. When they become distorted, it becomes rajas and tamas. So like a mirror, when it's in sattva, it's clean and it's not distorted. Right? So that's sattva. And the nature of this is that there is light. You can see things properly and you have a lot of peacefulness, contentment, discrimination. In fact, what yoga is to bring the mind to sattva. It had to bring the mind to sattva. Now, when the mind morphs to passion, intense desires, more and better, so it becomes more distorted. There's less light. It becomes very active, but there's less light. There's anxiety. And when it morphs into ignorance, and you have to see, look up, you see what the ignorance is, the passion, goodness. There's no light, there's no activity. Your mind is in ignorance, there's depression. No desire for activity. Your mind is in passion, There's a lot of anxieties. The mind is in goodness, very peaceful. Now, in this beautiful philosophy and science, it describes that there are three types of influences on the mind. And if you know how they influence the mind, the mind is malleable, right? According to the shape it's in, you'll feel a particular way. Actually, I'm just going to look at this. And the mind is swayed by three factors. Your karma, your previous activities, your destiny, your environment, and your actions. This is all I got from the Yoga Sutras. Therefore, by controlling the form or mode the mind takes, one can substantially influence how one feels. That's what yoga is about. You know that the mind is in different modes. You know how to bring, it's all about morphing the mind to sattva. Yam, niyam, asana, pratyaha, pranayam, it's all about morphing the mind to sattva. Okay, I'm going to explain a little bit about those factors. I'm trying to. Yes. Wow. You mean that we still have about 6 more hours? Wow, this is wonderful.
So, you know, I'm just reflecting on this. This is a very thinking set of spiritual concepts. There are many religions that have some commonality in it.
Yeah.
And one thing that I'm grappling with as you're talking about, this month, is there's so many religions that require blind faith, like complete you know, just acceptance of something that doesn't offer an opportunity to intuit. And, I mean, that can have its own danger to it. So how do you reconcile that concept?
Okay, you know, that's a wonderful question. I'll answer that question and then we'll take a break, okay? I think it's a wonderful question. You see, that's a misconception. I don't think any bona fide spiritual path requires blind faith. And I'll explain. In a real tradition, two things are required. I'll explain this really carefully. One is faithfulness, and one is thoughtfulness. Now, what you're assuming, if you find a spiritual path and you find a teacher, you'll be assuming that they have a higher level of perception and experience than you do. Okay. Now, to find that and accept that in a real tradition, it's required that that is tested. And a bona fide teacher will do the testing. Because they cannot teach a student that doesn't have faith or trust. And faith should be based on experience. For example, let's say I am a medical authority. Right? Now you come to me. Right? I know things about your body that you don't know. You may not even know what a pancreas is, you know, or something like that. And I may say, well, your pancreas is like this and that, and therefore you shouldn't take this and you shouldn't do this. Now, assuming I'm a medical authority, you cannot take a veil of my knowledge unless you have faith. But that faith should be tested. You should be asking me questions. Or you should see that I'm authorized from a bona fide medical school, that I'm authorized in a particular way. And even if I'm authorized in a particular way, you should ask questions and try me out. Now, I'll say you should take this, you should take this, and you should take that. If you experience good health, right, then you'll come back and we'll develop a relationship based on your experience. At a particular time, I may say, you have to have your pancreas removed. Right? And you'll say, yes, doctor. With complete faith. But it's reasonable because you had that experience. The other thing I should say in that type of relationship also is even if you find a proper authority, you also, and trust, if authority means not just they're in charge, but they have knowledge and teaching. Now, if you find that, then your intelligence is not pure, right? So what happens is, even if someone tells you something that's true, you may not understand it as true. You may not see it as true, right? People are Christians. People, they read the Bible. You know, some are social activists. Some are capitalists. Some are, you know, there's such a variety hearing the same thing. So what happens is, if you actually have a teacher, two things: that you have to have faith, because knowledge and experience is going to be beyond your experience. That's it. But if you hear something that belies your morality, belies your common sense, right? If you actually accept, I do have a teacher, then you have to have your doubts clear. You have to be able, you have to be thoughtful. Because if you're, one, it may not be the proper authority, but if you have accepted this person's an authority and this and this, then you say, well, I don't really understand it. You don't accept something that belies, and even if after explaining by the teacher and everything you don't understand it, then you can also be humble, say, this seems like it's not this and this and this. I can't accept it. I just don't understand it. But I'm not going to accept what I understood, which is something like this, which is not wrong. And in time, maybe it'll be clear. I have that with my own teacher. Sometimes I try to understand. I don't understand it. It seems something like that. It's not that I have to accept. I accept, yeah, it's true. I don't understand how it's true, because it doesn't really fit in with what I understand. So it says in a bona fide, at least in my path, bona fide understanding, you have to be faithful. Otherwise, you're limited to your own level of experience, and you have to be thoughtful. Because if you're not thoughtful, you'll be accepting things that are not true, not because what you were told is not true, but because you didn't have the mechanism to understand it is true. A very good question. So we'll just break for 5 minutes. Okay? I think we need that. So I think I need to get anybody else. But we need to take that break. Thank you.